Hello and welcome to The Boomerang Break. After an almost year-long hiatus, we are back with Wimbledon around the corner. We'll discuss two of the more imbalanced Grand Slam draws in recent memory, with Novak and Iga coming out of draw day feeling over the moon about their chances at SW19. Meanwhile, two shock announcements from Scandinavians means the far too premature end of one's career and the unforeseen rebirth of the others. But before we get to all that, we have the small matter to discuss of the entire sport of tennis potentially being taken over by an oppressive authoritarian regime at some point in the future. So, God help us all. You're listening to The Boomerang Break.
Welcome everybody to The Boomerang Break. My name is Ram. I'm joined as always by my guy Eli and EK. We got a lot to discuss today. Obviously Wimbledon coming up next week, but I feel like a lot of the stuff that we put on the talking points aren't necessarily Wimbledon related, which is interesting. A lot of storylines to discuss. Anything you're excited about in particular?
Just
anything about Wimbledon coming up.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Not my favorite major because Novak wins it every time. So the men's side is going to be a little bit boring, I think. But we're going to have a lot of fun clashes along the way. So even if the conclusion is inevitable, it'll still be a great 2 weeks. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens in the women's draw especially. So yeah, lots to look forward to.
Calendar slam alert if Novak were to win Wimbledon.
Calendar slam alert already.
Yeah, he would go to the U.S. Open with a chance, second time in 3 years, to complete the calendar slam, which again hasn't been achieved since Rod Laver did it in 69?
Something like that.
I'll get this. We'll talk about all that and the exact statistic later on. We're going to start off by talking about the PIF, so the ATP chairman and the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia have engaged in some talks. This was revealed about a week ago. The source we're going to be using is the Financial Times. So, what are your initial thoughts? Obviously, we had the merger in the world of golf between the PGA Tour and LIV. So the Public Investment Fund and the PGA Tour have agreed to merge, and it looks like now, Eli, they're moving from golf to both men's and women's tennis, and we'll talk about some of the nuances of that.
Yeah, it's no secret that Saudi Arabia is coming for the world of sport. They have been coming for years, but these past 2 years especially, they've seen their influence grow immensely, first with the purchase of Newcastle United by the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund, and then, as Ron mentioned, with the initial launch of the LIV Golf Tour as a competitor to the PGA Tour in the world of professional golf, which eventually led to the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund essentially taking over the sport of golf. You can sort of argue about the details of the merger, but at the end of the day, they are going to be the primary investor in that sport, and they're going to have a lot of influence in it. So just to be clear for those who are not aware of this, the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund is, and this is in the quotes of their lawyers themselves in a recent court case, they are a sovereign instrumentality of the Saudi Arabian government. So they manage the money of the Saudi Arabian government. They supposedly have sort of autonomous control over it, separate from the Saudi royal family, but the reality is that the board of the PIF is essentially the Saudi Arabian government. It's made up of a bunch of government ministers, the Minister of Commerce, the Minister of Finance, the Yasir al-Rumayyan, who's become the figurehead of Newcastle United and LIV Golf, is known as Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's right-hand man. So he was most likely influential in not just the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S. journalist, but also the implementation of a number of oppressive policies, including the Saudi Arabian guardianship system, which has been in place for ages, but was recently codified last year, which essentially stipulates that women have to obtain a male guardian's permission to marry. They have to obey their husbands. They have to basically be financially reliant on their husband. A husband can unilaterally divorce their wife, but a woman can only petition a court to dissolve their marriage. So essentially, there is a huge gender inequity enshrined in Saudi Arabian law. Homosexuality is criminal. It is illegal, and it can be punished by execution. So those are just a number of the oppressive human rights policies that Saudi Arabia has implemented under the regime of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And with the help of the same people that have bought golf, that have bought Newcastle United, and that are probably trying to buy tennis at some point in the future.
That's interesting that you say trying to buy tennis, because the chairman, Andrea Godensi, has been... He confirmed that there had been positive talks between them and the public investment fund. So I'm just going to read you some of his quotes. He said that outside investors must, quote, stick to respecting this history of the sport and the product, working with the current stakeholder rather than against. You have to preserve something which is almost sacred. The rules of the game. This is not a video game. This is not a movie. And he also made a distinction between the relationship between the ATP and the PIF as compared to golf, which we've talked about. Whereas with golf, you had the PGA Tour, and the PIF created a breakaway league to create kind of trouble within the space. That's clearly not going to happen. Well, at least you'd hope with reading some of the quotes by ATP that's not going to happen here. It's going to be more...
But what say does the ATP have in that?
It's tough, right? Because... money is obviously is a big driving force here. Where we want to get more cash flow into the sport. That's how you just have to go back to like the idea of a business, right? That's money is like the uniform driving. You need money to be able to run the business, and you look at it from another point of view. The public investment fund has has invested in so many different corporate. Partners within the U.S. and we're saying, okay, with golf and with tennis, do we need to hold the leaders in our sports higher than we hold the leaders in corporate? Do we treat those businesses differently because one is entertainment value and one is, I guess, sport? Which do we need to hold it morally to a higher standard?
I think we 100% do, and I think the reason we do is because Saudi Arabia is trying to accomplish something very specific with their investment in sports. When they invest in a corporation, they aren't really buying anything besides the stake in the corporation itself and the investment that comes from that. But when they buy a stake in a sport, when they buy a stake in a sports team, what they're essentially doing is they're laundering their reputation. They're trying to purchase a whole bunch of people in Western nations that might otherwise be hostile towards them. They're trying to purchase their opinions. They're trying to make them more favorable towards Saudi Arabia. And this is what we call sports washing, where they, you know, it's not a sound investment to just way overpay for Newcastle United and then spend $150 million in every transfer window to turn them into the best club in the world. They're not going to run a profit for a long time on doing that. What they're doing is they're trying to, and very successfully have done so far, is buy a huge audience of people who are all of a sudden going to support the Saudi Arabian royal family and will defend them to the hilt. They'll say, you know, they'll do anything for the Saudi Arabian royal family. And, you know, when 18 months before, they were probably against them. They probably had no idea who Yasir al-Rumayyan is. But now this whole city of Newcastle, with a few brave souls accepted, are very in favor of him. And so this is what they're doing. This is what sports washing is. And this is why I think it's important that we stand up against it, because it's not just, you know, we're taking their money. It's that they are trying to, this is a persuasion tactic. They are trying to pay for support in the West. And given that, I don't think we should stand for it.
Yeah. Basically, what I'm getting at is they're trying to gain soft power, basically,
yep,
through their investments and gain a sort of cultural influence that they wouldn't be able to necessarily, and maybe help with some of their image. We saw a lot of that last year with the World Cup held in Qatar. Qatar trying to manage its reputation by holding one of the biggest sporting events, if not the biggest, in the world. Billie Jean King has been one of many to comment on this issue. She thinks of the investment for the PIF would make in professional tennis, specifically women's professional tennis, to be positive. She says, quote, "I'm a huge believer in engagement. I don't think you change unless you engage." I would probably go there and talk to the PIF. And then the WTA chairman, Steve Simon, the chief executive, Steve Simon, says, "Sometimes when you're in the position we are in, you need to support the change." He said that Saudi Arabia has, quote, "a long way to go with regards to homosexuality." And this is interesting, Eli, because you have a few players on the WTA tour, including notably Daria Kazakina, who are homosexual. And there's an interesting balance you need to have there between what the WTA has traditionally stood for in regards to the rights of LGBTQ plus community, now having this investment in the public investment fund.
Yeah, for sure. I think, look, undoubtedly, there's a good reason why Billie Jean King and Steve Simon would want to engage with the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund, which is that it would be a huge step forward in their battle for equal pay. Like, they would get a lot of money. We've seen how much money Saudi Arabia has put into their sporting investments. And I think it's pretty clear that if the WTA were to receive investment from Saudi Arabia, they would be able to pay their players more. Now, at the same time, I think Billie Jean King has always held this mantra of, you know, stay in the room. That's always been her motto, right? Because if you don't stay in the room, then you can't accomplish anything. Even when she was negotiating with, you know, huge chauvinists and misogynists in the 1970s,
yeah,
she would always stay in the room and try to convince them, because unless you're in the room, then you have no leverage in the negotiation. So I fully support that. I think that's a great mantra to have. But at the same time, I would just really hope she is not being naive here when she goes and talks to the Saudi Arabian leaders, because I think there's really no reason to believe them in what they say, right? We, you know, Saudi Arabia provided legally binding assurances to the Premier League when they were, you know, trying to buy Newcastle United, that they were a completely separate entity from the Saudi Arabian government. This turned out to be not only not true, but within a year's time, we had Newcastle United's Twitter account referring to their chairman as His Excellency. So it's really there's been a lot of naivety around Saudi Arabia in the sporting world so far. And I would just really hope that Billie Jean King and Steve Simon, if they are going to enter those negotiations, which I don't think they should, they just need to be very careful, because I think they should take everything they hear with a grain of salt. I don't think they should be entering these negotiations in the first place, but if they feel they have to, then they have to be very careful.
Yeah, when you're talking about equal pay, this follows a WTA release on June 27th talking about how they're going to try to achieve equal pay in the near future. So we already have equal pay at the Grand Slams. Wimbledon was the last one to do it. You had Venus Williams. I was watching that a documentary with Venus and Wimbledon on ESPN the other day, and it was really interesting how she was able to get in the room anyway. More power to her case and kind of the legend she is in the sport, taking time out of her professional tennis to help achieve equal pay. Anyway, that's a rant for another day. But the WTA released a statement saying they're going to try to have equal pay at combined ATP and WTA 1,000 and 500 events by 2027 and at non-combined events by 2033. There's also other stuff to this about the adding more WTA 500 events and 1,000 events, as well as some stuff about which events players can play and which can't. But the main idea here is that they've been trying to achieve equal pay for a long time. This is a pathway for them to do it. But then you have to look at it from the other hand, right? If the PIF is also going to support the ATP, then they're going to get an influx of cash as well. So there's a lot to talk about with the PIF and the and I guess we'll have to see what details come out about what kind of investment they'll have. But yeah, it kind of seems inevitable, at least from my point of view, that they're going to get involved in tennis.
Yeah. And I think something that the WTA has to consider is that even though equal pay is, you know, a major goal of theirs, and rightly so, is it worth losing control of the brand? Because that's essentially what happens if Saudi Arabia takes over. And when I say takes over, I'm not talking about, you know, holding one WTA 500 in Saudi Arabia, because look, they did that in Doha. Qatar has some similar problems with human rights, and Billie Jean King, at the very least, has made a lot of efforts to try to improve conditions for women in Doha. And so if she is going to do the same in Saudi Arabia and is going to do her best, look, I don't think she's going to have a lot of power over the Saudi Arabian government, but I certainly think that's still a noble goal. The problem is that once Saudi Arabia has power over the entire WTA, then the WTA no longer has the brand, right? We saw that happen with the World Cup in Qatar, where even though FIFA purportedly wanted to support LGBTQ rights, they really didn't have any power because Qatar was the host nation and they got to set their own rules. And they essentially bullied FIFA, sort of bullied all of these nations into not supporting LGBTQ rights publicly at the World Cup. So there's really not a lot of control that the WTA is going to have once Saudi Arabia is a huge investor, once they're going there every year. You know, the PIF and the Saudi Arabian government can kind of set their own rules. And so given what the WTA claims to stand for in terms of equal rights, in terms of LGBTQ rights, is it worth risking those values and losing your brand for the sake of equal pay, which, you know, while it's tough, could probably be achieved in the long term in other ways?
Yeah. Talking about the brand that the WTA is trying to hold, they may recently, this year, made the partnership with Hologic, which is it supports women's health, and it's through that healthcare lens supporting equality that the WTA is kind of known for at this point. And this investment would kind of, tarnish some of that reputation, like you said. And then quickly, a couple notables. Saudi Arabia has already been involved in hosting tennis events. It's the front runner reportedly to host the Next Gen ATP Finals this year. And then there was that charity match that was supposed to happen a couple years ago in Riyadh between Novak Djokovic and Rafa Nadal. And that got postponed or canceled because Novak, I think, had an injury, but they've already been
There's involved. The exhibition every year in December.
Exactly. So they've definitely been involved in tennis. We could talk about this for a while, but I think it's let's move on to talk about some other topics. We do have a Grand Slam coming up next week, so let's take a look at Wimbledon. We're going to give you the preview. We'll go through the women's draw and the men's draw, but first, you mentioned it off the top, Eli. The women's draw, especially this year, is very one-sided in terms of most of the top players, most of the players in form right now are in the bottom half, with Iga, as you said, potentially getting a cakewalk through the final.
Yeah, I mean, look, Iga is not comfortable on grass, so there's a chance she could lose to anyone. But at the same time, I think this is the best draw she could have possibly asked for. And I'm personally disappointed about it, because I think there are a lot of really strong names in the bottom half of the draw that could have threatened Iga on her route to the final. And, you know, it means we're going to see probably some really good third and fourth round matches and quarterfinals on that bottom half of the draw. But ultimately, I want the best players playing in the latter stages of the tournament. And I think the top half, you know, the seeds in the top half might end up being decimated pretty early on. So Iga should be very, very happy about this. And there are some certain players in the bottom half who might not be. I think, Beatriz Haddad-Maia, Elena Ostapenko could have to play each other in the third round. Petra Kvitova and Ons Jabeur could have to play each other in the fourth round. So these are strong grass court players, strong contenders coming into Wimbledon that won't be very happy about their draw. Elena Rybakina, who the fitness element is very much a question mark, but she would have to play either Ostapenko or Haddad-Maia in that fourth round match. So super imbalanced, I would say. Besides Iga Swiatek, the 7 to 8 next best contenders for Wimbledon are all on the other half of the draw.
Yeah. Other notables in the bottom, obviously Sabalenka. Definitely has the easier of the two, her and Rybakina in that second half. But you got Krejcikova down there. You got Madison Keys, who's coming off the win in Eastbourne, was it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you got Maria Sakkari down there as well. So a bunch of the big names in the bottom half of the draw. And then you got Iga on top, some of the players she would have to go through to make the semifinals. You got Petra Martic, you got Belinda Bencic, Kazakhina, who's coming off a final appearance to Madison Keys in that Eastbourne event. Coco Gauff, who is picking up a little bit of form after that quarterfinal at the French Open and then beating Pegula in the tune-up event on grass. Pegula is in that second section of the draw, and she would go through Samsonova and Kudermetova are kind of the main people besides Caroline Garcia, and there's question marks about her too. Is she really the fifth seed in this draw? She doesn't seem like the fifth best contender. So those are the players that you would have to face potentially in the semifinals. So definitely in balance in this draw. I guess we can get into our picks then for the women's draw. Who do you, we can go quarterfinals, and then if there's any notables that we feel like we need to talk about, go ahead. So who do you have in the quarterfinals for the top half of the draw on the women's side?
Sure. So in the top half, I have Iga Świątek coming through the top quarter. I'll have her facing Daria Kasatkina in the quarterfinals, who just reached the final of Eastbourne, losing out to Keys, but has been in some good form on grass. Then this next quarter, I think, is going to be wide open. Not a lot to choose from, but I think Ludmila Samsonova is my pick. I never really trust her, but she's a good grass court player, so we'll see where that lands us. And then in that final quarter, I have Donna Vekic, who I feel pretty good about going into this tournament.
Yeah.
Having made the finals of, I believe it was Berlin, played an excellent match and still couldn't quite get past Kvitova. But
yeah, I have Coco Gauff in that first section. I think she's trending. Last year, she had that loss to Anisimova in the third round here at Wimbledon. And it's tough, right? Because she has such an extreme grip on her forehand that it's tough to be able to get down low and generate the kind of speed she needs off this low bouncing grass court, especially at Wimbledon. But she's been trending. She's got that quarterfinals, as I mentioned, at the French Open. And if she's able to use the power, especially off her serve, the way that we know she can, the when she beat Osaka at that Australian Open. But I know. I'm just saying my so I think Coco will definitely make that quarterfinal. I think she'll play Iga. Iga withdrew from the tune-up event in Bad Homburg, but you said, Eli, that she was spotted with her team later that day, so there's question marks about her fitness, but she turned all of those down.
Think she's fine.
Yeah, she turned all of those question marks down and should be she is the favorite to win Wimbledon, especially with the imbalance of this draw, but also her form coming in, having a 10-match winning streak, including steamrolling basically everybody besides Mukova at the French Open. For the second half of second section of the top half, I have Zhang Chunwen. I think she would be a good player, always sneaky coming out of that on any surface, really, but her first match against Siniakova, who is a great doubles player, and doubles usually translates to doing well at Wimbledon. You've got great net play, all great
and
hands
probably
in the net.
A titleist this week as well, Siniakova.
Yeah, so Siniakova, actually, I'll change it. I'll take Siniakova. I talked myself out of it. Siniakova making that quarterfinals, and then on the second half, I'll take Kudermetova, who's been playing some great tennis all around last couple of weeks. She did really well in Rome, and then, she always seems to thrive at this part of the season. I think she did well a couple weeks ago at one of the tune-up events, if I'm not mistaken, and she should be in good form this week.
Sounds good. I think the one question mark over that I have is Coco Gauff. That first round match, I think, could even be a big problem for her against Sofia Kenin, who came through the qualifying here. I watched her third round qualifying match against Taylor Townsend, who is a good grass court player in her own right, and Kenin was playing some pretty excellent tennis. So, you know, I never quite trust her, especially in 2023 when she's still on the comeback trail, but she is slowly but surely making progress, getting back towards where she really should be, which is in the top 20 and perhaps the top 10. So I'm not sure if she'll have what it takes to beat Coco Gauff, but I think in terms of grass court pedigree, I wouldn't be surprised whatsoever if Cannon took her out in the first round.
Yeah. Other notable matchup in that section would be Venus Williams against Aliyah Svitolina. Yeah. That's a popcorn match. Hopefully they put that one on center court.
Svitolina. Yeah, it is center court on the first day.
Svitolina is coming off a great French Open, which she lost in the quarterfinals to Sabalenka. And Venus played a tune-up event, which was a little bit surprising. Last week she looked good for the shape that she's in, and definitely gave Ostapenko, who was on a great winning streak, a good run for her money in that one. Okay, so we can move on to the bottom section of the draw. Just quickly on Kudermetova, I mentioned her earlier. She made the finals a couple weeks ago in the Netherlands, losing to Alexandrova, and then she beat Sabalenka in Berlin. So great, good form for her. Who do you have in this second half, starting with this all-important third quarter of the draw?
Yeah, so in this second half of the draw, I have Petra Kvitova coming out. I have her facing Yelena Ostapenko in the quarterfinals. Then in the next quarter, I have Madison Keys, who, as we mentioned, was a titleist this week. And then in the bottom quarter, I have Aryna Sabalenka. So I think that that quarter with Rybakina, Ostapenko, Haddad Maia is going to be tough, but ultimately I think Haddad Maia is still on a bit of a high from the French Open, and Rybakina, there are so many question marks over her health. She obviously withdrew from the French Open with an illness. She still seemed to be ill in her most recent loss to Donna Vekic in Eastbourne. I wouldn't be surprised if she actually had COVID and is still dealing with the long-term consequences of that. Obviously that can't be confirmed, but I just don't trust her enough, even as the defending champion, as I think when fit would be the favorite for this tournament. I don't quite see her making a deep run here.
Yeah. I agree. I still think her, she's becoming a major pit player, and I didn't think I would say that last year at Wimbledon, after she beat Jabeur, but she had a great run at Wimbledon last year. Of course, she had a great run losing in the finals at the Australian Open this year. She looked fit to make one of the, before the French Open, her form wasn't really that great. And then won Rome a couple of weeks before, looked great before she got that illness. So that illness really puts everything into question, but she's becoming a really major player. And I would not be surprised by the end of her career if she got more than, let's say, 6 Grand Slams. I think that's how good she is. I think that's the ceiling. I think she's a big game hunter, and I think she'll make the quarterfinals this week just with that all-around game, and especially how flat she hits the ball being an advantage here on the grass court. She can definitely beat someone here with her C game, but I don't think she'll win it. I think she'll make the quarters. I think she's going to play Kvitova, like you said, in that quarterfinal matchup. Kvitova coming off a win at a 500 event in the tune-up. Good decision for her, I think, to take last week off, really focus on Wimbledon. She's a 2-time champion of here, of course. Got that great wide serve, and her forehand, it's really stunning. I was watching one of her matches in the warm-up, and how she would kind of angle her return position on one side of the court so she'd get more of their forehand opportunities, and the other side would be neutral, again, to create an advantage off that lefty wing. So I think she's looking good there. And then for the bottom section of the draw, I got Barbara Krejcikova and Aryna Sabalenka. Krejcikova, again, a great doubles player. She lost to Ostapenko a couple of weeks ago in a final of a warm-up tournament, and then Sabalenka, she blows everyone away with her serve. The double faults have not been an issue so far this year, so I think that will be my quarterfinal lineup. Who do you have in the semis and then winning this thing?
Sure. So in the semifinal, I have Iga Swiatek against Donna Vekic. Then I'll have Petra Kvitova against Aryna Sabalenka. Swiatek in the final, and then that Kvitova-Sabalenka match, I think, if it happens, which obviously there's a lot that needs to happen before we get to that point, but if it does happen, I think that one could really, really go either way, because if Kvitova is at the point where she's in the semifinals, it means she is absolutely peaking. But in the grand scheme of the whole tournament, I think I like Aryna Sabalenka to make the final more than anyone else, so I will go with her, and I will go with her to win this tournament altogether, because I think she, you know, with that Mukova match in the semifinals of the French Open, she did choke, but other than that, she has been absolutely flawless at slams this year, and with her game, with the power she has and with the question marks that still exist over Iga Świątek on grass. I like Sabalenka all the way here.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I got Iga Świątek and Kudermetova in that semifinal match with Kudermetova coming out on top. I like Iga's progression on grass. I definitely think over the next couple of years she'll win this tournament, but I think give her a little bit more time, still coming off that high of the French Open. She's used the time between the French Open and Wimbledon really well, so I definitely think this could be a breakthrough for her, but I'm not sure fully that this tournament is the one for her to get it done. If it happens, good for her, and she's definitely has a little bit less pressure this time around than last year when she had that 30-something odd winning streak going into the semifinals. So if she wins it, good for her. The other people on the bottom half of the draw, I have Petra Kvitova, and then I think it's a toss-up there between Krejcikova and Sabalenka. Sabalenka is obviously really good, fit to win this tournament. She made the semifinals a couple of years ago here, losing to Karolina Pliskova in a great three-set match. So overall for the title, I think right now, out of those four, my favorite would probably be Kvitova, even though it's been a long time for her in the semifinals of a Grand Slam. I think she's ready. She looked really good in the warm-up tournament. The only thing I saw that she was having a little bit of trouble with was the body serve, but I think give her some time, especially on these grass courts, as it becomes more like a hard court towards the end of the tournament with the with the grass becoming browner, I think she'll do well there. And yeah, I think she's my pick right now to win Wimbledon, but a lot still to go, and Iga definitely the favorite.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly reasonable. The one thing I would say is, how many times have we had Petra Kvitova in this position before, when she's absolutely peaking in the weeks leading up to a Grand Slam and she's burning everyone, thinking that, you know, this is the one, she's going to go all the way, and then doesn't quite do it. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't bet against her given the way she played in that Berlin final, which was an absolutely cracking final between her and Donna Vekic. They were both ripping the ball, hitting winners left and right, and ultimately Kvitova was just too much. So I can't fault that pick at all.
Sure. Kvitova, for what it's worth, has not made the quarters at Wimbledon since 2014. So it would be a while for her, but I think it'd be also a really cool story and put a good stamp on her comeback since having that stabbing. Shall we move on to the men's section of the draw?
Let's do it.
Okay. Feel free to go first with Alcaraz, the top seed, having regained that number one ranking with the win at Queen's Club.
Yeah, just thinking about the draw as a whole, I know Rom disagrees here, but I also think this is a pretty imbalanced draw, with Alcaraz having a much tougher route to the final than Djokovic. Alcaraz, just in his little section, would have to play Nicolas Jarry in the third round, would have to play either Alexander Zverev or Alex de Minaur in the fourth round, and then a potential quarterfinal against Holger Rune or Francis Tiafoe. So those are some strong players in his quarter of the draw. Daniel Medvedev and Stefanos Tsitsipas, both also on the top half. Sebastian Korda, Andy Murray in the top half. And then Djokovic's half contains, you know, still some dangerous players, but players with a lot more question marks, I think. He would have a potential fourth round against Hubert Hurkacz, a potential quarterfinal against Nick Kyrgios if he's remotely fit, but other than that, perhaps Alexander Bublik, Andrei Rublev, Felix Auger-Aliassime are all in this section, with Andrei Rublev to play Djokovic in the quarters. So I think if any of those were closer to Djokovic, I think it would be a tougher draw. But given that those four players are all battling it out for one spot in the quarterfinals, then, you know, I think Djokovic should be very happy about his half of the draw. And then that other quarter with Casper Ruud and Jannik Sinner and Taylor Fritz is so wide open that I don't think Djokovic will have much of a hard time getting to the finals of this tournament.
Yeah. The other section of the draw that he would have to play in the semifinals, I don't know if you mentioned this, was Jannik Sinner.
Yeah, I just said that.
Okay. So that would be interesting for sure. You kind of went over the whole draw. I was hoping I would get some part of it. But it's all good. I guess we can move on to some of the picks then. A couple of popcorn first-round matches include Stefanos Tsitsipas against Dominic Thiem. They played each other recently, with Andy Murray potentially getting the winner of that one. So a lot of big names in that section. And then you have other guys like Ben Shelton. I think his game is really suited for the grass. And he would be in that second section of the draw. as well. Yeah, if you want to get into some of the picks, let's go right ahead.
Okay, so in the first section, I do have Carlos Alcaraz coming out. I don't think that's a foregone conclusion. I think there are, as I mentioned, some players in there who could really challenge him if he's not on his game and he is still struggling to adapt to the grass. That said, he did win Queens. He played really, really well in those last couple matches at the Queens Club. And it would be a little bit foolish, I think, to not have him as the favorite to at least get to the quarterfinals here. Then in that next section, I have Francis Tiafo. I think he's a player who peaks for majors, and I expect him to do so again here and reach the quarterfinals. Then in this next quarter, I'm going for Talon Griekspoor. I think Medvedev on grass has really surprisingly not proven himself whatsoever. I would really expect Daniil Medvedev to be a great grass court player given his big serve and his flat strokes. I think his shots have the potential to have the most impact on grass, but he hasn't shown it. He has had a number of disappointing results at Wimbledon. Obviously, he was banned last year, but the year before, losing to Marin Cilic in straight sets here. And then Tommy Paul, Francisco Cerúndolo, also in that little section, but they literally just played a final against each other, and, you know, could be a little tired, not that I haven't picked other finalists, but whatever. Talon Griekspoor is a great grass court player. He already won a title here. He played great in Halle, and I don't know, that's my surprise pick, I guess. And then my fourth quarterfinalist is going to be Sebastian Korda. The big question mark is with the body. Not sure if it holds up, but if it does, I think he'll get through that section.
Yeah. Quickly on Medvedev, it's interesting because he stands so far back on the court to return serve. That's why he's really good at hard court when he has a little bit more time. But I noticed, especially in Halle, he was having trouble adapting. He would stand so far back, and he would give his opponent so much time, so then the opponent could just come to net every time and finish him off. So he's trying to take a hard court game and really move it to the grass courts when I think his net play is good enough. His serve is good enough. His serve will blow everybody off the court that if he was willing to come closer to the baseline and kind of chip some of those returns back in play. I love to see Medvedev, you know, chip and charge a little bit like Roger did. I'm not saying he has necessarily the game enough to do that right now, but listen, I don't know what Medvedev kind of needs on his return of serve, but I'd like to see him stand a little bit closer to try to get into some of those points, because he's not going to beat Novak standing at the back wall of center court. And I think, like you said, the rest of his game is kind of suited for the grass courts, especially with how flat he hits the ball. For my picks for the top half, I do also have Alcaraz and Tiafo. Francis was a big star in the recent Breakpoint series that came out. Highly suggest you all watch that. It's amazing. The second half is definitely a lot better than the first half from my perspective. And then for the second section of the draw, which is where Medvedev was, I think there's a couple big names in there that could definitely go far. I would probably also take Cerúndolo to get through that section of the draw, just given how well he played recently. I think he can take that form forward. And then for the second part, I'm going to go with Seb Korda as well. Fourth round match here last year, losing to Karen Khachanov when it went deep into the fifth set. I think to a...
2 years ago, I think.
That was two years ago, yeah. But Seb Korda really suited for the grass, beat Francis, and had a good match with Alcaraz in the semifinals. I think it was 4-4, but he definitely played really well. So those are my four for the top half. If you want to go to the bottom half.
Yeah, just quickly on the top half, I was really split between Seb Korda and Andy Murray for that one, because I think Andy Murray does have a really good chance to go far here. With a first-round match against Ryan Peniston and then a potential second-round match against either Stefanos Tsitsipas or Dominic Thiem. I think he will beat Tsitsipas or Thiem, whoever comes through that, which will probably be Tsitsipas. But ultimately, I think about the matchup between Andy Murray and Seb Korda, and I think if that does happen in the fourth round, Korda will just have a little bit too much power for him. So, yeah, that one could really go either way if it happens. And I think there's a chance Cam Nori could stop Seb Korda before, you know, he gets to the fourth round. Ben Shelton, as Ron mentioned, also dangerous. So a lot of dangerous names in that section. But I think all in all, Seb Korda has the highest ceiling. And if he isn't injured, then he'll end up there.
Yeah, Mari skipped the French Open to focus on getting ready for Wimbledon. He won two smaller events leading up to Queen's Club.
Challengers.
Yeah, two challenger events. Didn't do too well at Queen's Club, lost 3-1 to Mari, to Dimonor. Can't lose to himself, but or Kenny. But yeah, Mari definitely with some extra time rest. He's the favorite, crowd favorite for sure here at Wimbledon. Won the title back in 2016, so yeah, he's definitely dangerous on the grass and will definitely have the home court advantage as well. Moving on to the bottom section of the draw, let's start with that third quarter headlined by Casper Ruud as the top seed, but maybe not as the favorite.
Yeah, I'm going to tentatively go Jannik Sinner. Ruud, I don't really think will be a factor here. I was considering Fritz, but he actually has a really tough first-round match against Yannick Kampfmann, and given the way Fritz has had some disappointing slam results at the last three slams since reaching the quarterfinals here, losing to Alexei Popperin, losing to Brandon Holt, I think that can be a really difficult match for Fritz against Kampfmann in that first round. And even though there are question marks over Sinner's fitness, having retired in Halle, and having looked a little bit gassed late in that match against Altmaier at the French Open, I'll tentatively go for him. I have him facing Roberto Bautista Agut in the quarterfinals, in that quarter with Ruud, or that little section with Ruud, rather. I think Bautista Agut has had a bit of a nightmare season, but you saw him just start to find some form in Halle on the grass. He's a former semifinalist here, so I like him. This next section, which I alluded to earlier, with Rublev, Kyrgios, Bublik, and Ojeda Aliassime. I've gone for Bublik. this seems silly because he should be a victim of the Halle curse, which is that every non-Roger Federer winner of Halle since, I think, like 2010 or something, has lost in the first round of Wimbledon.
Is that real? Yeah. That's crazy stat.
We had Hubert Hurkacz last year, before that Hugo Humbert, Philip Kohlschreiber, all the way back. So he has Mackie McDonald in the first round. 50-50, he loses, but I'm still going for him because I think Rublev could get played off the court by someone with a bigger serve like Kyrgios, Bublik, or Ojeda Aliassime. Ojeda Aliassime, still a lot of question marks. Kyrgios hasn't won a match all year, is only just came back, and looked completely unfit in his only match of the grass court season. So I'm going Bublik. And then we don't really need to talk about this last one. It's Novak Djokovic.
Is he good on grass? I'm
not sure.
Yeah. Okay, so I basically have the same four picks as you, besides instead of taking Bublik, I got Andrei Rublev. He's really consistent, making a lot of quarterfinals. He lost that final to Bublik in Halle. It was a three-set match. He didn't have a great French Open, losing to Sonego in five sets in the third round, but his game really translates to all the services. He's got great topspin, which helps him on the clay. He's a great hardcore player, and then just because with his power that he generates, especially off the forehand wing, he can blow a lot of opponents off of the court. So I have, the same four as you: Sinner, Bautista Agut, Rublev, and Novak. So only difference to Rublev pick.
I think Rublev is definitely the safe pick. I just think if any one of those other three is playing well between Ojeda Aliassime, Bublik, and Kyrgios, then they will beat Rublev. But it's just a question of whether any of them show up.
If Kyrgios is healthy, watch out, because that would be fun, especially what he did last year. Who do you have making the semifinals and eventually winning?
Want to start?
Sure. I have Alcaraz and Djokovic for sure on the top and the bottom. I think Alcaraz is so underrated at this point still. And it's crazy to think that, but even on the grass courts, his drop shot is so, so effective. And you talk about having good drop shots on the grass, it dies so quickly. And the way he was playing it, kind of running around the forehand to hit a cross court drop, he can go from he can hit it anywhere on the court. When he runs around his forehand, he can smash it straight down the line, or he could hit a cross-court drop shot, and the deception that he uses is so amazing. And within a couple matches at the Queen's Club, he adapted so quickly to the grass, had a tough match here last year against Sinner, but I think he's suited for this. I think he's going to win this for sure in the next couple of years. To be honest, The other two semifinalists are a little bit up in the air. For now, I'll go with Sepp Korda and Jannik Sinner. But for me, it's Alcaraz and Novak in the final again. Hopefully, Alcaraz doesn't cramp this time, and I think it'll be a great match. I think with Novak winning four of these in a row, you have to go with Novak as the safe pick. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if Alcaraz managed to pip him in the final.
Yeah. That's very convincing, everything you said. I was really just sitting here debating that Alcaraz-Tiafoe quarterfinal, because I think there is a really good chance that Tiafoe unsettles him and makes him uncomfortable if that quarterfinal does happen, because Tiafoe is someone who is so comfortable with the grass beneath his feet. It's his favorite surface. He is going to come into the net all the time. He's going to rush Alcaraz, just make him uncomfortable. But your case was strong, and I think Alcaraz is going to find a way through that. I think he'll play Korda in the semifinals, and then I think Djokovic will play Bautista Agut in the semifinals. I don't see Sinner making that breakthrough into a Grand Slam semifinal. And I'll, same as you, Djokovic Alcaraz in the final. And yeah, you can't bet against Djokovic. I, as much as I would love for Alcaraz to win this tournament, I think all in all, he has a much tougher route to the final, which, you know, means there's a, just, yeah, he's less likely to win this thing than Djokovic is. Djokovic is, you know, looking for a five-peat, so I think he'll get it, and I think he'll be on course for the calendar slam.
Did Roger, who is the last person to win five of the same Grand Slam in a row? Was it Roger at the US Open?
I think Roger at the US Open.
So that would be cool for sure. Yeah. Add another one, would it be eight Wimbledon titles, something like that?
Or did Rafa do five at the French at some point?
Oh, yeah, for sure. He had to, no?
I'm not 100%
2010
sure.
to 2014. Yeah, okay. He did it. So all three would have that stat then, too. Not saying Novak couldn't get it elsewhere at the moment. As you mentioned up in the intro, we do have a couple of players. One is a couple of retirements. One is announcing a comeback to the tour. So we'll start here with Caroline Wozniacki. I do realize we've been going for 45 minutes already, but I think these are really important. So Wozniacki had that breakthrough win at the Australian Open, winning against Simona Halep. Didn't have really amazing results after that. She wrote a Vogue essay recently. She had rheumatoid arthritis coming back and having a couple of tough seasons, and then just said she needed a break from tennis. And we'll get to some of these quotes, but needed a break from tennis, had a couple of kids. And last year, she was hitting the ball. She's like, man, I'm feeling really good about it. And she decides to give it another run and come back to the tour.
I am so excited for Caroline Wozniacki to come back. I mean, I love comebacks generally. I get very invested in them, whether it be, you know, that little Kim Clijsters comeback, which was not super successful, or, you know, Andy Murray, Dominic Thiem. I love when players who we thought we'd never see again re-enter the scene. And I was a huge, huge Caroline Wozniacki fan back in the day. She will immediately become my favorite player on the tour, at least until Naomi Osaka returns in 2024. But yeah, I just could not be more thrilled to see her back. And on a broader level, I think it's important that the WTA still has high quality players who have a more consistent game style, because I think the upper echelon of the WTA tour has become pretty power heavy between Swiatek, Rybakina, Sabalenka.
You'd consider Swiatek as part of that Sabalenka Rybakina category?
Not quite, but I also don't think, like, I think, you know, there was a golden age of the WTA in my mind when we had Kerber, Halep, Stevens, Wozniacki, Radwanska. You know, you could go on.
Counterpunchers.
Yeah, like Kerber. Did I say her already?
No, but she's the perfect description.
Yeah, I mean, she's Svitolina. There were so many. I might have said her Kerber already, but whatever. There were so many great players who, you know, someone called them pushers. I think I would say that colloquially, but on the podcast, I'm going to be more respectful. But I love those players. I think I love, like, you know, one of my favorite set of tennis of all time was the first set of the 2018 French Open between Simona Halep and Sloane Stephens. What a set. And I think that Australian Open that Wozniacki won, when she We had like Halep Kerber in the semifinals. We had Wozniacki Halep in the finals. They're just some beautiful tennis to watch. So yeah. I'm really excited to watch her. I hope she, you know, she expressed a lot of confidence in her abilities to win Slam still. I'm not so sure, but I hope to see her in the latter stages of big tournaments because I think it'd be awesome.
So she said definitively she's going to play the U.S. Open. Leading into that, she'll play Montreal, and then just to get back into the swing of things, definitely, she said the New York atmosphere is something she loves so much. Her husband was a member of the New York Knicks for 5 seasons, so that's an interesting parallel there. And then she said after that, Australian Open maybe, and a goal to play in the Olympics in Paris. I'll read you what she said in that Vogue essay, which I highly suggest you all to read. How long I will be able to play, will I be able to play at the highest level, a year, 2 years, 3 years, I don't know. But I know that 5 years from now, when the kids are in school, it will be too late. I'm not going to make any bold predictions, but if I didn't believe in myself, I wouldn't be doing this. I'm too competitive to just show up and not feel like I'm going to be one of the best players out there. I think the WTA Tour would be in a great spot if she was one of the best players in the world again, and definitely a lot of excitement about her comeback. We do have to get to a couple of retirements. One of them is Annette Canavate. She was number two in the world playing Serena last year, in the second round at the US Open, has fallen all the way down into the 70s and 80s of the world rankings, complaining of chronic back pain. And, it's really sad to see Eli given, where she was. And then, anytime a player has to retire due to injury is tough, but in her case, it happens also quickly.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was only, a year and a half ago when she was playing the best tennis of her life, going on a huge run after the U.S. Open in that indoor hard court season to, you know, sneak into the WTA finals and then ultimately make the finals of that tournament in Guadalajara, losing out to Muguruza. It looked like she was on the up, that she was going to become a big contender, and then she really hasn't been the same since. She is suffering with a lumbar disc degeneration, which I think is basically incurable. There's some stem cell research on the way, which might be able to help out with it. But it's degenerating that disc in the spine, and it's just, she said it was impossible to play high level tennis with it. So it's just absolutely devastating. She's one of the nicest players on tour. Everyone loves her. It's really just a real shame. She's only 27 and could have had a hugely successful career ahead of her. But yeah, it's brutal. The sport is brutal.
Yeah. Highest ranked player from Estonia in tennis. And she says, quote, "I'm ready for new challenges after my last effort as a professional tennis player to enjoy the game and compete as hard as I can at Wimbledon." So Wimbledon will be her last official match, and or maybe more if she's
and
able
she
to.
She has a workable draw. I think she could win a match.
Yeah, starts against Stefanini, the Italian, in the first round. Yeah. Last retirement we'll get to, only two, is Feli Lopez. Made his final tournament at Mallorca in Spain, in his home country. And he's most known, I think, for the stat that he, from 2002 to 2022, he didn't miss a Grand Slam. That's 79 straight major appearances, which is the record, I think, by far. It was Federer in second at some point. I'm not sure. But anyway, it just speaks to his longevity in the sport and how he is continually being able to put himself at the highest level time after time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he was so consistent on the ATP Tour for such a long time. And really what will stick out to me in my memory of him was just his artistry on the court. He was really a beautiful player, played with great technique, came to the net a lot, beautiful volleys. I'll always also remember that run with Andy Murray to the doubles title in Queens when Murray was returning from his hip resurfacing surgery, and then he also, Feli Lopez, won the singles title that year. That was a super special moment that I think at least the British public will remember for a long time. So, best wishes to him in his retirement.
Mm-hmm. He called that week the best week of his career, and he was also one of only a handful, but not many people have won 500 matches on the ATP Tour, having done that last year. Yeah, I think it was 500 and a couple of matches that he had managed to get, which speaks again to his longevity in the sport. All right, is there anything else you want to get to on the retirements, or can we move ahead to your favorite segment of the show?
I think we can. It is Pablo Corner. Unfortunately, this is a very somber segment at the moment because Pablo is nowhere to be found on the ATP Tour. He has been injured practically all year. His last match was in Marseille against Richard Gasquet, which he lost. He's had an elbow injury. In the intervening months, he has appeared in the main draw of Madrid and Indian Wells before that, but both times he withdrew right before. It is unclear when he plans to return, but he is not in the entry list for Wimbledon. He is not on the entry list for either of the 2 weeks after Wimbledon when he would normally be playing Bastad and Hamburg, where he's a former champion. And it seems like he's about to be facing a very tough decision about whether to even play Montreal and defend his 1,000 points from last year, because if he does not play Montreal, then he will secure a protected ranking, which means he will be free to enter 9 tournaments on his previous ranking, which will be around 20 in the world, or even higher than that, will be in the top 20. So he'll be able to enter any tournament he wants 9 times over the next year. But at the same time, he will also practically drop off the face of the earth in the ATP rankings, and so he will have to work his way back up. So if he thinks he is fit and in with the chance of defending his Montreal points, obviously he won't win the tournament, but he, you know, if he can defend some of them, then maybe it's worth it. But otherwise, I think he might have to take the hit, take the protected ranking, and work his way back up. He's done it before. He did it in 2019, not to the same extent, but he fell out of the top 70 and then worked his way back up. So he can do it again, but he's nearing his 32nd birthday, so time is of the essence.
All right. I didn't know about the protected ranking. So, yes, his big win. We did a whole episode last year. On the...
How times have changed.
On Pablo and his journey to winning in Montreal, but... Definitely sad to see that he's been out from the tour for so long. Is there anything else in this mega Wimbledon episode that you'd like to get to? I want to say quickly about Breakpoint. The stars of the second half of the show, it talks about that big Nick Kyrgios-Stefano Tsitsipas match in the third round. Goes really deep into Ons Jabeur, Ayla Tomljanovic. Her dad is a big story a big character in the second half of the season. He's a really funny guy. Goes into talking with Aryna Sabalenka, Iga Swiatek, Francis Tiafoe's journey at the U.S. Open, as well as others. So highly suggest you check that out. Besides that, we'll put a link to the Vogue essay by Caroline Wozniacki in the description. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
I would like to give a premature shout-out/jinx to Chris Eubanks, who's currently playing in his first ATP final. He's up a set and a break against grass court specialist Adrian Manarino. I don't know if he'll be able to close it out, but if he does, that would be awesome because I love Chris Eubanks. He's one of the nicest guys on the ATP Tour. Someone everyone can really root for. And he's had a long journey to this point. He would, I think, has entered the top 50, and if not, certainly would with a win here. So just great to see. Really, really good guy.
Great. Thank you, Eli, for joining me on this episode of the Boomerang Break. Hopefully, it'll be a great grass court major at Wimbledon, and we look forward to bringing you all the action from there. This is the Boomerang Break. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
See ya. Enchanted.com.